This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level, Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with regenerative radio waves. This warms your brain to a crispy and crunchy 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working? Yeah, I can feel it. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So we're going to be doing something a little bit different tonight. This is Lou, and I'm going to be flying solo for a little while. We're supposed to have Cal, but he's not connected yet. So we're going to see what's going on. I did send the cat signal out to Michael, and maybe he'll get in there. So what's been going on? What's new and exciting lately? Well, last week I was down in the Fail State Project region for Friendsgiving, or AnFam, Family Harvest, Fall Harvest, commonly known as Thanksgiving. It was a pretty good time because I got a chance to spend the weekend with my good friends down there. And what was really nice about it was it wasn't like the typical or stereotypical family event where you have a bunch of people getting together and they don't particularly care for each other, but they try to play nice a couple times out of the year, and they wind up fighting, bickering, and arguing. And it wasn't like this. It was a bunch of people that choose to be together. Basically, my friend Danny, she puts together a little thing each year, and it's people that don't have family in the area, or they choose not to be with their family, and we all get together, and everybody brings some stuff, or people contribute a little bit of money to pay for the meal. And I wound up cooking the turkey again. It was a 27-pound turkey, and that thing's a monster. I thought it was going to throw me into the roasting pan. but it came up pretty good. It was a good time, and I also roasted up a couple porchettas and made up the gravy. And my friend Danny, she did a bang up job. She made a paleo stuffing, which is made with pork sausage and I think turnips and maybe some other stuff, parsnips maybe, I don't know. But oh my God, it tastes like actual real stuffing. And there was a cauliflower mash that tastes like actual real mashed potatoes, but it's paleo friendly or whatever. I don't really understand all that stuff, but good times. So Back up in Bear Sketch One after traveling abroad, and back on the Fiends. So tonight's stories, I'm going to start off with an article from the New York Post, and it says, people are fleeing New York at an alarming rate. I wonder why. More people are leaving the New York region than any other major metropolitan area in the country. More than 1 million people moved out of the New York area to other parts of the country since 2010, a rate of 4.4%, the highest negative net migration rate among the nation's large population centers, U.S. Census records show. The number of people leaving the region, which includes parts of New Jersey, Connecticut, and the lower Hudson Valley and Long Island, in 1 year swelled from 187,034 in 2015 to 223,423 in 2016. So that's almost a quarter of a million people. Wow, that's quite a bit. While the number of international migrants settling in the tri-state area dwindled from 181,551 to 160,324 over the same period, records show. So apparently people are not seeing New York as a destination or a place to stay. The nation's economy is improving. There are more jobs and cheaper places to live, and retirees are choosing to move to warmer climates, experts say. I won't argue with the warmer climates part. The historical trend is that out-migration grows when the economy is getting better, said Empire Center for Public Policy Research Director E.J. McMahon. The economy gets better, there are more jobs outside the region, and by the same token, more people to buy your house if you're a baby boomer looking to move to Boca Raton or Myrtle Beach. The New York metro area remains the most populous in the country with 23.7 million residents. Americans have been increasingly relocating from the eastern U.S. and the Rust Belt to cities in Florida, Texas, and the Northwest. The Orlando-Daytona Beach area attracted 217,104 Americans to its shores over the past 6 years, a growth rate of 7.7%. Denver had the second highest rate of domestic migrants, 6.3, followed by Houston, 4.7, Dallas-Fort Worth, 4.6, and Portland, Oregon, 3.9, according to census records compiled by the Empire Center. Now, it's amazing that these people in these other places aren't demanding that a wall be put up to keep those New Yorkers out. The population of the New York region still grew 2.7% from 2010 to 2016, thanks to foreign arrivals and births, records show. New York City, the main driver of the region's population, is on track to have 8.6 million people by 2020 from a current population of 8.5 million, according to July 2016 records. Something is really interesting about this is even though people are leaving, the population is going up. In Detroit, in the heyday, it was just under 2 million. I think it was about 1.9 million people there at some point in the 1950s. And currently, it's around maybe 650,000, between 650,000 and 700,000. A lot of people have left over the years. The suburban communities around there, Warren and Troy and Sterling Heights and things, a lot of the businesses moved out of there, out of Detroit, and gone out to those places and set up shop because it provided a much better environment. And I would imagine that a lot of the businesses and people leaving New York City are going out to, as I mentioned, lower cost of living, but also probably a bit more business friendly. Because from what I know of New York City, it's not an easy place to run a business. A lot of government and regulations and nonsense there. But the area's growth is slowing down. The region's population rose 0.5% from July 2012 to July 2013, but only inched upward 0.1% from July 2015 to July 2016, records show. Some 422,045 people, or 4.3%, have left Chicago since 2010, the second highest negative migration rate after New York. So, I would imagine that in a lot of cases, it's government driving people out of there. With the cost of living, I was recently listening to an old interview with Walter Williams by Tom Woods, and he was talking about the both rent control and then also the price of a taxi medallion in New York City. With the rent control, because because landlords can't raise the price of living somewhere, they're less likely to put in the work to keep the place up to snuff and make sure everything is repaired in a timely manner, even putting new paint on the walls. They're less likely to do that. Then also with the taxi medallions, the license of a taxi in, I believe it's Washington, D.C., was somewhere around maybe $200, something like that. In comparison, in New York City, the cost of a taxi medallion made it up to probably around $1 million, which means that in order to get a license to run a taxi, you had to pay $1 million, and most people weren't able to come up with $1 million, so you didn't have a whole lot of new taxis coming out. So there you have barriers to entry that are just absolutely killing business growth, and business isn't moving forward. It's coming to a standstill. And when it comes to starting up new businesses, it gets really tough. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that you have things like Uber and Lyft. Those are the result of the the taxi and limo services as they existed, stifling growth, causing high prices and everything else, and people are forced to find alternative options. So, yeah, Uber and Lyft, they're the answer to the problems caused by not necessarily monopolies, but definitely cartelization and restricting competition. I have another article here, and it talks about the elusive Bitcoin millionaires that I'm going to go into. So this comes to us from Reason Magazine. It's by Brian Doherty, and it starts off with, "I am not a Bitcoin millionaire. I could have been. I was one of the cryptocurrencies. I was aware of the cryptocurrencies experience in July 2010. I should have been. Dozens of smart people with simpatico worldviews to my own eagerly explained to me how the creation of an online blockchain, a reliable yet anonymous ledger of transactions, had the potential to change the world. And I would have been had I shelled out, say, $2,000 on this innovative anti-inflationary currency, even a lazy 6 weeks after I was introduced to it. Today I would be sitting on 28,571 bitcoins, the equivalent at press time of over $212 million in cash. But I didn't. Libertarians have long contemplated the potential power of a currency free of government interference, control, or devaluation. Unsurprisingly, I found early Bitcoin fanatics galore at Ron Paul campaign rallies and meetups, Free State Project get-togethers, and Seasteader soirees. Back in 2011, finding someone to sell you bitcoins was difficult for U.S. citizens. Many of the enthusiasts I talked to then were excited about blockchain mining operations, essentially a way to anonymously use electricity and computer processing power to solve cryptographic problems and receive a certain amount of Bitcoin as a reward. This was a marvelous technological leap, and internet-enabled delivery on the promise libertarians had been buzzing about ever since F.A. Hayek's 1976 monograph, Denationalization of Money. The question we have to consider, the Nobel Prize-winning economist had written, is whether competition between the issues of clearly distinguishable kinds of currency consisting of different units would give us a better kind of money than we have ever had. And we'll be back.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
The central scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Fiends, this is Lou, and I'm back, and I've been going over an article from Reason Magazine. It's called In Search of the Elusive Bitcoin Billionaire. Bitcoin is booming. Libertarians were there first. So where are all the cryptocurrency tycoons? Continuing with the article, the question we have to consider, the Nobel Prize winning economist had written, is whether competition between the issuers of clearly distinguishable kinds of currency consisting of different units would not give us a better kind of money than we have ever had. And I just saw an interview earlier today. It was posted on MSN.com with the Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor Joseph Stiglitz, and I'm kind of the mind that after Hayek got the Nobel Prize in economics, that it became more of a Nobel participation trophy, because you have people like this guy here, Stieglitz, and then you have Paul Krugman. I'm not super familiar with Stieglitz. I mean, he might be pretty brilliant on everything else, but on this one, it was just absolutely ridiculous. In this article, or in this interview, he said that it's a legitimate function of government to create currencies, which, okay, you can argue that. But he said that the only useful purpose that Bitcoin has is to circumvent government. Okay, what's wrong with that? And because of that, it should be outlawed immediately. He says that it has absolutely no social value, and we need to go back to what we've always done. And this is really, I don't know if this is a Luddite type of idea of, hey, let's avoid anything new. Let's keep riding horses. Forget about those automobiles. We don't want to mess with that. Horse and buggy was just fine for the past couple hundred years, so let's keep doing it. Forget about, you know, going fast and getting there in a fraction of the time. But anyway, it was really interesting, because I think a lot of these folks that are on these different panels on these news shows, they have no idea what they're talking about when it comes to this technology of Bitcoin. But going back to what Hayek says here is, if we can have a competition of money, because after all, competition is good, monopoly is bad. Monopoly always brings higher prices and lower quality. So if you have a competition in money, isn't that going to give you better purchasing power and create prosperity, or at least to preserve prosperity? So there are a number of qualities people might seek in a currency, such as relative stability and value, that Bitcoin definitely lacks. But the thing about the fluctuations in Bitcoin is, if it's fluctuating, it's because there's things happening. If it stays absolutely the same, if it doesn't fluctuate, if it has that stability, it means nothing's happening, or very little is happening. But if you measure better by an ability to acquire more in goods and services, Bitcoin so far has proven superior to the U.S. dollar and other countries' government-based fiat currencies. Less than a decade into its life, the digital token has enjoyed what is likely the largest, quickest rise in asset value in the history of the human race. From a starting point of $0.0003, and it's like 0.3 cents, a single Bitcoin is now worth $74.32, an increase in dollar terms of 2.4 million fold in less than 8 years. That $7,432, that's a little ways back. It was up just under, I think, 11,000, the high was I saw earlier today, and then it was just below 10,000 later on in the afternoon, so I'm not sure where it's at right now. Yet those early adopters weren't focused primarily on wealth magnification. No one thought of it as an investment vehicle in those first couple of years, says Isaac Morehouse, a libertarian who runs a startup apprentice program called Praxis. It felt more like fun and like a charity, even. Like, if you are a libertarian, you should buy it and use it. Bear this cost and inconvenience to support it. The concept of having stateless money alone was enough. It was like Christians saying, go support this movie because it has a Christian message. Not necessarily because it's a great movie. Holding Bitcoin felt like being part of history, like holding a piece of the Berlin Wall. Now, I do have to admit that when I first heard of Bitcoin, it was probably maybe 2011, 2012, something like that. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it had been out for a couple of years. And I was very skeptical because I'm not the most tech savvy. I was just like, meh, Bitcoin, whatever. So, all right, we'll be back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Biptunia, music for the drive to Alpha Centauri. Biptunia's influences are Gary Numan, Brian Eno, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, Robert Fripp, Blondie, Kraftwerk, and Dead Kennedys. Biptunia styles are trip-hop, rock, pop, glam, industrial, ambient, jazz, and space. Plus, it's got cats and is covered by the BipCot NoGov license. You can download Biptunia's music free. go to biptunia.com. That's B-I-P-T-U-N-I-A. Bravo, India, Papa, Tango, Uniform, November, India, Alpha. biptunia.com.
Freedom Fiends, and we are back. Well, I'm back. This is Lou, and I'm joined by myself tonight. All right, back to the article here, and this is once again from Reason Magazine. It's called In Search of the Elusive Bitcoin Billionaire, or maybe Millionaire. I'd have to go scroll back up to the title. Bitcoin has always had its bulls, of course. Rick Falkvinge, I think I'm saying that right. Founder of Sweden's Pirate Party, a political party dedicated to informational freedom and privacy, announced on his website in May 2011 that he was going all in on Bitcoin with everything he had. Why? Because he saw a thousandfold increase in the crypto coin's value within 4 years. Falkvinge was brutally savaged on Reddit's r Bitcoin online message board for such hubris. The top voted comment on his post, reflecting mass opinion of Bitcoin enthusiasts, declared that, "I can't even begin to comprehend the depths of the stupidity of that kind of reasoning." When Falkvinge was wrong, it took 6 years, not four, for Bitcoin's value to hit 3,000, 1,000 times the $3 it was worth when he made the announcement. Not too shabby. Then again, it took just another 4 months for it to break 6,000. The $74 million pizzas. My first traceable record of seeing the word Bitcoin was in a pitch email from then Reason intern Jesse Klein on July 1st, 2010, less than 18 months after the first token was sent from its inventor, the pseudonymous Satoshi Nakamoto, to cryptographer Hal Finney. I know this because after the currency's value first jumped above 1,000 in November 2013, I remember those days. Oh my God, it was crazy. People were really excited, and people were talking about hodling, and they were just so sad about the Bitcoin that they had spent or sold at 500. And oh gosh, oh wow. That a little side note here. As far as technology goes, It's really an amazing time to be alive. So maybe I'll cover a little bit more of that later on. In November 2013, I went back and searched my Gmail to see just how badly I'd missed the boat. Klein's pitch received serious consideration, but we decided it was too complicated to explain in the tight 165 words of the section it was intended for. So Reason did not publish in our October 2010 issue a brief squib explaining Bitcoin. Sorry, everyone. Our first mention of the free market cryptocurrency came several months later in an April blog post by Jesse Walker. If you were savvy enough to have dropped $2,000 on Bitcoin that week, your holdings would earn you $6.1 million today. I failed to identify Bitcoin as a burningly important story in July 2010. Not because I didn't grok how amazingly promising the concept was, but because I knew perhaps too much for my own good about the world of experimental internet currencies that libertarians were wont to hype. I remembered eGold, an earlier attempt to create digital money backed by precious metals. In 2007, as I reported at the time, the operators were shut down by the Department of Justice on charges of money laundering, conspiracy, and operating an unlicensed money transmitting business. Bitcoin's decentralized nature at least makes that bad end impossible. It's really amazing how competition and trying to create something is criminalized. And here you have a currency that it won't lose value, so it will help people to maintain their prosperity. And a lot of people is going to take them from poverty into prosperity if they get involved in it. But it provides so many solutions to all these different problems, and the response to problem solving is a SWAT team. It's a cage. It's men with guns. I saw a meme earlier today, and it was a three-panel meme. I've seen the first two panels of it many times over the past couple of years. First one, it shows a picture of a church and says there's 350,000 churches in the country. Then down below that, it shows a homeless man sleeping on the sidewalk and says, "So why are there 200,000 homeless people sleeping on the streets?" And I'd seen that meme many, many times before, but today I saw a different panel below it, and it was a screen cap of a headline out of a news article that says, "Church fined $12,000 for allowing homeless people to sleep on the property. Why is it criminalized to help people and to solve problems?" I know I'm going off on a rant here, but up where I live here in Bear Saskatchewan, there's not homeless shelters or anything like that. There's none in this particular county. So the local clergy association got together a couple of years ago. They started this out, and they decided that they would get together and have a rotating shelter during the cold winter months. And it gets cold up here. Today, in the daytime, it was 18 degrees. That's pretty darn cold. So it didn't take long to figure out who was going to do what and come up with air mattresses and bedding and things like that. That was relatively quick. That was probably maybe a week or two. And that includes one of the churches having a shuttle van that they could donate to go around and pick people up in the community. Folks that needed a ride to the shelter at night. So they go up and down the main highway here, and it's like a bus schedule. They have stops at certain times, and they pick people up and take them to shelter at night. It took well over a year for this to come to fruition. It didn't take long to figure out how it was going to be done, but it took well over a year for it to come to fruition. And a lot of that time was gobbled up by getting permission to help people. And not just asking, okay, can we have permission to help people? Yeah, sure, go ahead. No, it was all the groveling. It was all the nonsense that goes along with getting permission. And it reminds me of that story of the old World War II vet down in Florida who kept getting arrested for feeding the homeless out there. And the mayor, I can never find that article anymore, but the mayor is quoted as saying something to the effect of, if they think that they can feed people outside of government, they're wrong. If you think you can do this on your own without the government, you're wrong. What does that mean? What does that mean? Are we under occupation or something? Because that's the attitude that projects. It's absolutely mind-numbing, the hubris of these people. But anyway, back to the story here. After Bitcoin broke 1,000, a widely circulated anecdote from 3 years prior helped fire imaginations about the opportunities one could hit and miss using the currency. It seems that in May 2010, a first mover named Laszlo Hanek, I think, or Hanish, who had the amazing foresight to accumulate many thousands of early Bitcoins, made this catastrophically short-sighted mistake of spending 10,000 of the things on all of two pizzas. So this was referred to as the pizza problem, and because the first documented Bitcoin purchase was pizzas. The valuation of that pair of pies today, around $74 million. May 22nd was thereafter known as Pizza Day in crypto circles. But surely Hanish wasn't the only one to accumulate that many or even more Bitcoins early on. Surely some of the early miners and the folks who bought them for pennies, one token traded for under a dime until early October 2010, didn't blow their stash all on junk food. If even half of the libertarians I'd met in 2011 who were so jazzed about Bitcoin had, say, put a month's salary into it within the currency's first year, shouldn't the Free State Project now command a combined wealth exceeding that of some small nations? One of the Bitcoin wealthiest libertarians I spoke to for this story, who has to be identified as Jason, says he took what he admits was a crazy risk by seeking around $100,000, about half of what he'd made flipping South California real estate after starting with a small inheritance into Bitcoin at 2011. His prices allowed him to live a very interesting life of travel and to live generously to liberty oriented causes, as well as more traditional philanthropy, such as ending tropical diseases. His burn rate is $20,000 to $30,000 per month.
Wow.
Yet, if many libertarians managed to go from rags to riches by being early adopters of Bitcoin, the holders of this new wealth would have been stubbornly elusive, an oft-derided radical edge of the American political spectrum, may have finally notched a win with an absurdly huge potential financial upside. But the specific winners are, by and large, anonymous. I managed to find and communicate with around 24 people whose libertarianism made them aware early of Bitcoin's awesome potential. It turns out that converting early awareness and even early adoption into fiat currency, mega wealth, was a good deal trickier than envious boatmisters like me might have guessed. Bitcoin barriers. Someone's Bitcoin wealth is hard to ferret out if he's not inclined to spill his guts. Despite the public nature of the blockchain on which it resides, coins are tethered together to digital wallets with specific public addresses on the chain, but those addresses are not necessarily tied to any notable individual. A few people who I know to be big Bitcoin enthusiasts in 2011 declined to respond to my nosy inquiries about their Bitcoin holdings. And many of those who did insisted their names and financial specifics be kept dark. In the early days, as if to advertise the comparative illiberalism of the existing bank credit system, Bitcoin exchanges, out of fear of onerous U.S. regulations, only did business with American citizens via international wire transfer. Jonathan Rael, an objectivist libertarian who works in medical software tech and first heard about Bitcoin from Reason, remembers going to online forums and learning to go to a 7-Eleven and wire something via Western Union to somebody and give them an address and hope they follow through. Yeah, you have to buy Bitcoin in a back alley out of a back of a van. Oh, gosh. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Hi, this is Mark Edge of Free Talk Live. Michael W. Dean's book, User's Manual for the Human Experience, changed my life. In a culture that attempts to turn you into a compliant victim, this book gives you implementable steps on everything from how to be aware of your environment walking down the street to business, to how to handle a toxic person in your life. If you're a human, you need to read this book at least once. Go to Amazon and get the Kindle version, or paperback, or an audiobook of A User's Manual for the Human Experience.
Freedom Fiends. This is Lou, and I'm talking about Bitcoin and the search for the elusive Bitcoin billionaire. Now, we ended the last segment talking about how the early exchanges involved going to send wire transfers from like a 7-Eleven or something like that via Western Union or something similar, and sending it overseas and then hoping that the Bitcoin would arrive in your wallet. And it would appear that it did. But the reason for that was because the banking system was horribly unfriendly to Bitcoin transactions. The regulatory environment is absolute nonsense. So people they did what they do best. They adapted and they circumvented government and found other ways to do it. Now there are exchanges domestically, and they're providing U.S. customers and doing bank transfers. I mean, as example, Coinbase. I've never used Coinbase, and I've heard mixed things about them. But Coinbase, you can you can have money taken out of your bank account or possibly even your paycheck each week or every 2 weeks and purchase Bitcoin with it. So it has gone a bit more mainstream here, but when you look at just all the different things that go along with it, and my understanding is that the IRS has contacted Coinbase and asked for customer information and things like that. So there's no telling what the privacy level is with these different exchanges. I personally have never bought any Bitcoin through a exchange. I've got my Bitcoin by selling food at the different festivals and things like that, or private transactions with friends. They buy something off me and they pay in Bitcoin, or I've bought Bitcoin from friends of mine. So that was my way. That was my exchange. So anyway, Charles Perrello, an early adopter who ran for chair of the Libertarian National Committee in 2016, remembers just going onto Facebook groups and asking, "Hey, will anyone sell me some Bitcoin? How'd that work out?" In part, he says, it led to some people ripping me off. Learning how to set up your computer to mine Bitcoins in the very early days often involved trying to trace detailed instructions from places such as Reddit. One early adopter, Josh Smith, now a data management engineer who used to work at a state-level free market think tank, missed out on who knows how much wealth because he had a mining apparatus which was set up to restart whenever the computer restarted. But at some point, I think I did an operating system upgrade and changed something so it wasn't restarting with the machine. At the time, each Bitcoin still worth less than $10. It seemed like no big deal, but there's a good chance his mining, had it continued, could have earned him an easy million or more at current Bitcoin prices. I remember seeing the documentary The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin in the theater a couple years ago. It was before I moved to Bear Saskatchewan, so it was probably sometime in late 2014, early 2015, and just looking at the changes in the mining equipment. It used to be to where you could use your home computer and mine Bitcoin, but then as the equations got more difficult, you couldn't use a regular computer. You had to buy special mining equipment. It got to a point to where the equipment was almost obsolete by the time it got to you. So it was really crazy how that went. Anyway, Mike Mosseri, a lawyer, was mining back when he got 50 bitcoins for each cryptographic problem your computer solved. The reward is half that now, per the original programming for Bitcoin that ramps down the number of new ones created through time. Eventually, the stock will be capped at 21 million tokens. I thought of it as a fun social experiment, a technical project, and I never imagined, even in my wildest expectation, that it would go beyond a dollar, Mosseri said. He sent it around to friends, did this and that, but after Bitcoin passed dollar parity, then doubled that, sold half of it immediately. I figured I may as well make $50 off of it. He mined more later in the era when the simple central processing units on every laptop were generally replaced by more robust graphics processing units. Nowadays, more expensive specialized equipment is necessary to be seriously in the game for Bitcoin mining. For Mosseri, they got me through law school and paid for a laptop and a few months' rent. And now, I have no Bitcoins today, he says. We'll be back, or I'll be back, with the second hour.
Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell 411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell 411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell 411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell411 has decentralized ride-sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
Freedom Beat, second hour. Something about the Ion Cannon and all of their stuff. I don't have the introduction up. But anyway, yeah, broadcasting from the Libertarian Reeducation Camp, beating the non-aggression principle into you one syllable at a time. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So anyway, we are back and we're talking about the Reason magazine article "In Search of the Elusive Bitcoin Billionaires: Libertarians Changing the World." Roger Ver was already a millionaire when he recreated himself as Bitcoin Jesus, the great evangelist for crypto coin, changing the world and redeeming the many sins of the Federal Reserve. In December 2013, Ver donated 1,000 bitcoins to the Libertarian Foundation for Economic Education, FEE. Had FEE held on to the gift, its value would now exceed the organization's entire yearly take in 2016. Instead, as FEE's finance director, Carl Oberg, explained in an email, the FEE board addressed it as any other non-cash investment. They directed us to sell some of the coins and put the proceeds into the structure of FEE's normal investment policy. In September 2017, Ver demonstrated vividly what it might mean for efforts to change the world that at least one libertarian had used Bitcoin to become fabulously rich. He and his associates announced they were prepared to spend $100 million actuating an ancient libertarian movement dream to create a new sovereign nation. In Ver's case, by literally buying land from an existing country, the deal is still pending, and he won't name any governments he's negotiating with yet. Is he just a libertarian lone wolf or the harbinger of status worst nightmare? Anarcho-capitalists with earth-shaking budgets. He asserts we're beginning to see the rough outlines of a giant transfer of wealth to people that are libertarians, crypto-anarchists, people of that mindset, including his public partner in this endeavor, former Bitcoin Foundation board member Olivier Janssen. We are a very small percent of the world population and feeling rather alone, Fair says. When I found online Bitcoin forums in early 2011, he thought, here are my people. They see the world the same way I do. So Ver started to grow the pie, including by giving away very small bits from a fraction of a Bitcoin to an entire token at different times to as many members of New Hampshire's Free State Project as he could. Ver says he's heard from hundreds of libertarians who tell him that his advice to get into Bitcoin early and heavy made them modest millionaires, if not world-shakingly wealthy power brokers. In my search for people who struck it rich, I took to asking libertarians in the Bitcoin world this question. Is anyone you knew to be a Bitcoin enthusiast exhibiting signs of unusual wealth, publicly or clandestinely? In response, a Facebook friend mentioned that the host of one of his favorite podcasts was suddenly talking about his new 35-foot catamaran. Something that's really interesting that goes along with this whole Bitcoin phenomenon, the people that he's talking about here, these are regular people that you would sit down by at the food court at the shopping mall. These are people that you would see at take away the whole libertarian aspect of it, of, you know, somebody that you might meet at Liberty Fest or Pork Fest or something like that. These are people that, I mean, they take their kids to putt-putt golf and they do all the same things that you do. I mean, they are the regular folk. And one of the big complaints, and in some regards it's legitimate, in some regards it's hyperbolic, but when it comes to, I don't want to use the distribution of wealth, because wealth isn't actually distributed, it's accumulated and earned and created and everything else, but when you look at who has money, in many cases, it stays with the same people for generations and generations. So it stays in particular families, and it does escape out a little bit. It's not like a caste system where if you're born a peasant and you're destined to buy a peasant and you stay, there's no question about it, you can't get out of being a peasant because you can. But I think traditionally, more people stay where they start. And there is upward mobility, but most people pretty much stay where they are. So if that makes sense to you. But what this does is this takes the common person, the regular Joe that you, like I said, you sit across from them at the food court in the shopping mall, eating your burritos or whatever it is that you got, and they're probably wearing their blue jeans and their t-shirt and their sneakers, but who knows? Maybe they're a millionaire. You don't know. Maybe they do have the 35-foot catamaran. But anyway, In my search for people who struck it rich, I took to asking libertarians in the Bitcoin world this question. Okay, so we got that. That would be Mark Edge, one of the voices of the Keene, New Hampshire-based radio program, Free Talk Live. Edge thinks he and his radio partner, Ian Freeman, were the first nationally distributed media to mention cryptocurrency. Gavin Anderson, who became one of the Bitcoin Project's lead developers after Satoshi Nakamoto disappeared from the scene, was a donor to their show. He took Edge and Freeman out to a Thai restaurant to explain to them this magical internet money, as Edge puts it. Edge had all the elementary complaints about the idea at first, he recalls. What's it backed by? That sort of thing. Anderson adroitly stepped around those questions in a wall that I found plausible. Edge, who reckons his show was the first media entity to accept Bitcoins in exchange for advertising, claims the mantle of Bitcoin John the Baptist, since Bear first heard about the currency on Edge's Free Talk Live podcast. I graduated to a full smartphone data plan just because I wanted to look at Bitcoin prices all day, Edge recalls. Over the next 6 years, he and Freeman have helped to make their hometown of Keene the per capita U.S. capital for brick-and-mortar Bitcoin commerce. You can now use crypto to buy everything from Brazilian jiu-jitsu lessons and haircuts to soda at the corner store and beer at the local bar. Edge likes to pay workers on his farm in Bitcoin if they're amenable. Freeman manages a couple of Bitcoin vending machines in the state, which have dispensed over $140,000 worth of the currency. Down in the Metro Detroit area, where I was living before I moved to Bear Saskatchewan, there's a handful of local businesses that will take Bitcoin. I was down at when I was down there for the holiday weekend, I went to a Bitcoin meetup at a local bar called Brewery Becker in Brighton, Michigan. And they accept Bitcoin, and they've been taking Bitcoin since probably before I moved up here. Another one that I can think of is the Bronx Deli in Farmington Hills, Michigan, which is another place where the meetups have been held. But up here in Bear Saskatchewan, I don't know if anybody that's accepting it business wise. And I did run across somebody in a Facebook group that had mentioned Bitcoin usage. To my knowledge, he's not a libertarian. I don't know the guy. But, yeah, so there's not a lot of adoption up here, but this is a pretty rural area. So I don't expect to run into too many. So is Edge a digital multimillionaire? Well, there is that catamaran, the sovereign nation of Summer Breeze. I bribed my son by letting him be admiral if he voted against making my wife king for life, but he insists he's not living like a mogul. Whatever number of bitcoins have passed through his hands, he won't specify, are now the legal property of the Shire Free Church, an institution he co-founded in 2013 to bring peace, freedom, and personal responsibility to the world at large. His early adoption is definitely helping to finance ideological goals. It's not only a political calling, he says, it's a moral calling we have. Going back to this discussion about financing ideological goals. One of the probably the largest use of Bitcoin, my understanding is charitable donations. At least that's what it was a couple of years ago, and I probably half of my transactions where I've sent money out were donations to people who needed assistance of some sort or another. So I would pay in Bitcoin. It was an easy way to drop somebody $20 as a donation to help get them through hard times, whether it's a legal defense or somebody's just having hard times. They lost their job and they need some help. So I've used it as a donation. As a matter of fact, mentioned Roger Ver earlier in the article. Not too long ago, there was a event held on behalf of Ross Ulbricht for the Free Ross Project, and they were trying to raise money to fund his appeal. And I'm going to talk about that later on. Thank you, Nathan. But Roger Ver, all the contributions that came in, Roger Ver matched it. So I think it was about $14,000 that came in, something like that, for the different donations to help fund it. And Roger Ver matched all of it. So that's something that Bitcoin can do. It's not just magic internet drug money like the naysayers think that it is. So Cal, you're here?
Yeah, buddy, I'm here.
Okay, welcome. Welcome, yeah, nice to have you.
It's not all about assassination squads regarding Bitcoin.
Right. Interestingly enough, those charges were dropped. They never went forward with them. There's no evidence to support it. Yet, in Ross's sentencing, the murder for hire was used to justify his double life sentence. But we'll talk about that more. It's absolutely crazy. So, Edge is proud of using Bitcoin to raise money for a Ugandan orphanage, and he introduced me to a friend, a Romanian immigrant named Virgil Vaduva, who used his crypto wealth to launch Cell 411, a decentralized non-state emergency response app that has more than 73,000 global users. And Cell 411, we're big fans of it here on the Freedom Fiends. Cell 411 is a solution to another government problem. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Here we go. Freedom Fiends, and we are back. This is Lou, and I'm joined by Cal. Welcome to the program, Cal.
Yeah.
And we are talking about still doing this article, In Search of the Elusive Bitcoin Billionaires. And we just started talking about Cell 411. And as I mentioned before, Freedom Fiends were fans of Cell 411 because it solves a problem. Just like Bitcoin in the blockchain are the problem solver for the banking system and the lousy money, just as Uber and Lyft are the solution to the taxi and limo problem, just as all these different creative, Joseph Schumpeter called it creative destruction, where new technology comes along and destroys the old archaic stuff. So just as the automobile is a solution to the horse and buggy, you have cell 411 to where if you have an emergency, you can contact friends in your group and they will probably get there quicker than the cops. And your friends probably won't shoot your dog. You can stream video on this. And it will go onto a server so that when if the cops take your phone, they can't just delete it because they can't get into the server to delete it. So they can break your phone, but you're still going to have the video. So cell 411, it's a good thing to have.
Like I have said,
it solves the problems. Okay. How does it work? Because I don't use it, and I probably don't have anybody within 400 miles that could be in my network. Seriously.
No,
I live in Bear Saskatchewan.
Yeah, it's a great app. I didn't know who actually put it together until it was like, what, a week or two ago, Virgil. But I've had it on my phone for a few months now. And it's a great, here in Richmond, good community kind of app. Like it's not even just for even for police. It's like you get into trouble or your car breaks down or any kind of emergency and you just kind of press the button and it kind of sends out automatically like a recording. What's going on, like a voice recording, a video recording. And so, you know, everyone's notified, which I think is kind of ingenious. So you don't have to kind of finagle your way in a moment of distress and trying to figure out what's going on or what you need to do. It does it automatically. I think it's pretty in a something that's definitely needed out here.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I tell you what, it's nice to live in a quiet rural area. Why would I go downstate to Detroit area? I have to ride down the mountain on the back of a Yeti, get to the bottom of the mountain, take the sled dog team over to the Mackinac Bridge, get a rental car, and drive on down to Detroit. But it would sure be nice if I could get people into these different things because, quite frankly, a lot of these folks up here, they do have that rugged, individualistic, self-reliant, or cooperating with their neighbors mentality. So, but unfortunately they still have that residual statism that's in there. But anyway, back to the article.
Yeah, I think I saw you write in at the festival on a horse buggy or something, right?
That was I don't know, maybe my unicorn. But anyway, so going back to the article, once again, Edge is proud of using Bitcoin to raise money for a Ugandan orphanage. So, yeah, charitable donations, helping people out overseas. And quite frankly, a lot of these different charities have gotten really banged up. You know, the mainstream charities, they've gotten banged up for not using the money as intended because by the time it actually gets to the people, all these cuts have been taken. Everybody's getting their taste of the action, it seems like. Anyway, Cody Wilson, the inventor of the first 3D printed gun and also an early Bitcoin adopter, is disappointed there isn't more freedom-oriented new big money in the space. Instead of the same tech industry venture capital, Wilson credits his own startup, which makes a ghost gunner, a home mill allowing anyone to produce untraceable metal guns via computerized instructions, to his cashing out 200 Bitcoins. But he doesn't think he's seeing anyone else take a bunch of Bitcoin and build a great American company or new innovation. Now, it's pretty interesting, though, because I don't know how closely you follow Cody and the 3D printing and all this other stuff. One of the nice things with the 3D printing, he did the Liberator and threw the plans out there. And the government says, no, you can't have these plans out there. They have to be taken down. And they were taken down, and they were found on Pirate Bay like a minute later because they were everywhere.
Right.
Cody will do more to protect gun ownership than the NRA, the Second Amendment, and every voter, politician, and petition signer combined.
Now we'll you can back. Print out your own...
Listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Freedom Fiends, and we are back. This is Lou, and I'm joined by Cal. Yo! So, I'm going to end the Reason article. There's still plenty left on there, and if you're interested in reading more of it, I would advise you to go to reason.com or do the Google search for In Search of the Elusive Bitcoin Billionaire, because there's still some more interesting stuff in there that I've seen. But I want to move on now to a story from Wired Magazine, because I mentioned this earlier, and this ties in. Silk Road creator Ross Ulbricht loses his life sentence appeal. So this came out 5/31/17, May 31st of 2017. So I don't know if there's more appeals going on. There was recently an interview with Lynn Ulbricht, that's Ross's mother, on the Tom Woods Show, and I've met her at Porkfest, and also
me too. Yeah, I met her at Porkfest too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talked to her online. You were at Midwest Peace of Liberty Fest, and she Skyped in. There was a showing of, gosh, what was the name of that movie? Dark Web, I think it was. Yeah, yeah. Dark Web. So there was a screening of the movie Dark Web, and then she came on afterwards to talk about Ross. So I think at the time, still had an appeal going. But anyway, so this article here is not very timely, but this kind of ties into some of the stuff. Now, after more than 5 years, the saga of the Dread Pirate Roberts has ended, and the founder of the Silk Road has lost his last chance of escaping a lifetime in prison. On Wednesday, a Second Circuit appellate court rejected the appeal of Ross Ulbricht, who 2 years ago was sentenced to life in prison without parole for creating and running the Silk Road, a massive dark web drug market. Ulbricht, who used the Dread Pirates Robert pseudonym, had persistently fought his conviction for crimes including drug trafficking and money laundering, as well as his unexpectedly harsh life sentence. He and his lawyers pointed to what they described as illegal searches in the investigation, the involvement of at least two federal agents now proven to be corrupt, and Ulbricht's draconian punishment for what they described as nonviolent crimes. The three-judge appellate panel nonetheless affirmed the decision of the lower court, albeit with notes of muted criticism of American drug laws. Reasonable people may do and disagree about the social utility of harsh sentences for the distribution of controlled substances, or even of criminal prohibition of their sale and use at all. The appellate court's opinion reads, "It is very possible that at some future point we will come to regard these policies as tragic mistakes and adopt less punitive and more effective methods of reducing the incidence and costs of drug use. At this point in our history, however, the democratically elected representatives of the people have opted for a policy of prohibition backed by severe punishment," the judge wrote. So bleep you.
Yeah, I remember those two agents that were involved in the case were caught.
Aren't they in jail?
Yeah.
Aren't they in prison right now?
I think so, right? By now? Yeah, they were caught taking the Bitcoins from that case.
Yeah, there were a number of... how could I put it? Strange inconsistencies in the investigative process there.
Right.
Yeah.
This is horrible. This is really bad. He lost his appeal case.
Mm-hmm. Now, like I said, I'm pretty sure that this is an older article, and there may still be stuff going on right now. This was a particular one, but this goes back to part of the theme for tonight. The Silk Road is a solution to the problems created by the war on drugs. Most people out there, I'm sure you've probably seen this in Richmond. It's not exactly rural Bear Saskatchewan down there. Do you guys have violence over the drug trade there?
Yeah, there have been related deaths. There have been a lot of bad case news, even Richmond, in regards to drugs in themselves. Opiums, especially, is a problem here. So yeah, mm-hmm. I would say so.
Yeah. I can't count how many people that I've talked to over the years, and I used to be one of these people, so I'm sympathetic to their view, but there are a number of people out there that think the shootings over drug territory or the drug deal gone bad. Somebody goes to buy a bag of weed, and the deal goes bad, and they get shot. They blame the drugs on this, just in the same way that guns are blamed for shootings. And strangely enough, a lot of times it's the people that say guns don't kill people, people kill people. They will blame a bag of weed for a deal gone bad. You know, so they'll say, well, people don't kill people, weed kills people. But strangely right. enough, weed doesn't kill people at all. So they have this idea that this violence is a product of the drugs rather than the prohibition, the illicit markets created by prohibition. And what this did do, yeah, there's the allegations of the murder for hire, but they didn't go forward with it. I'm pretty sure if they could have proven it, they would have. As a matter of fact, I think in Maryland, they still have charges pending that they've never pursued. They've been sitting on the books for a few years now. But
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're right.
It's crazy. It's,
a lot of the violence comes from the difficulty in trying to find arbitration in these kinds of trades, right? So since it's illegal, in the first place, you can't find restitution. You can't find any form of like negotiation because it would be deemed illegal and criminal. Right, you go to jail for it if you were trying to dispute, you know, whether this is a good sample or it was a good trade or whatever were to happen. And so for most of these people, the default would be, you know, violence or, you know, things that are not, you know, good worthy and facing court.
Yeah, but in spite of the nonsense allegations about the non-existent murder for hire stuff that he was accused of, Silk Road took the violence out of the drug deal. It eliminated the drug deal gone bad because people would order, and yes, they would pay in Bitcoin. So in that regard, yeah, it was magic internet drug money, but U.S. dollars are used as magic real-life drug money too. But you didn't have people getting shot up or stabbed or beaten up when they go to meet their dealer because they didn't go meet their dealer. So this created an element of safety that was taken away by prohibition. It solved part of the violence problem. And my understanding of it is I never used the Silk Web. I don't know about the dark web and Tor and all that other stuff. I still have an AOL email that I use.
Oh my God, it's
my spam folder, but you know, hey, it's older than some of the hosts on the show here. But the thing is where was I going with this? I started talking about AOL.
You're right. AOL. It doesn't
all my memory cached. Yeah,
it
got rid of the violence. Yeah. But I understand that they also had an arbitration of sorts. So my understanding of what would happen is if there was a purchase, the Bitcoin would be held in escrow by a third party. And when you had confirmation of receipt of the sold goods, it was more than just illegal drugs. There was a lot of stuff sold on there. But once you had confirmation of receipt and that the deal was fulfilled, then the money was released out of the escrow account to the seller. And I also understand that there was a rating system for buyers and sellers.
Exactly.
So it was kind of like Yelp or Angie's List.
Right. Like there's you know, you go on Etsy and you have a rating review system. You have a rating system in which people like go in there and you have people who you value their opinion and reviewing certain products. The same thing occurred in the black market. You had a group of people, for example, called like the LSD Avengers, and they would rate the drugs that came out there, especially like you know, hallucinogens, for example. And people would trust their opinion on the matter. So there was like a weird Etsy version of it in the darknet, which a lot of people were able to trust, and you wouldn't have like all these bad drugs or bad paraphernalia coming out there. So you would have a weird dark market effect and reaction towards that that help minimize, de-escalate a lot of violence that would otherwise have occurred.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really amazing. People always say, but without government regulating business, you know, kind of like they regulate the banks and the U.S. dollar and the healthcare field and education, all this stuff that's expensive, it doesn't work very well. They say without the government regulating things, you'd have poison drugs on the street and blah, blah, blah. And the reason that the poison drugs are out on the street is because of the government regulation, because of the illicit market. That's the cause of not just the poison, but the violence, the deals gone bad, the fights over turf. And all this stuff, it's just absolutely mind-blowing what's happened. And here you have an unregulated, or let me rephrase, a market that's not regulated by government, and it's eliminating these things.
Right. I mean, you always point at the example of Portugal, right? Over a decade ago, they decriminalized all drugs, right? And you didn't find, like, oh, these people, like, there's an increase of, like, drug uses or anything like that. Everything, the opposite happened. Drug uses rates went down. Diseases associated with shared needles went down. The deaths associated with
HIV
went down.
Right, HIV especially. Plummeted.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And everything improved. Everything improved when you got government out of the situation.
Mm-hmm. And something that they did, and I don't particularly agree with this, but given the choice between turning it into a social, dealing it as a public health problem versus dealing it as a criminal problem, I'll choose public health problem any day, because it's a lot less destructive. I rarely see that not be dealt with by government at all. But by turning it not having it as a criminal program or program, I guess that could be accurate. Not having it as being dealt with as a criminal problem really alleviated a lot of the problems. I mean, not just the ones that you mentioned, but you lower the cost of the number of cops that you have to have out there. And fiscal conservatives should love the idea of reducing the number of government employees and the number of taxpayer funded pensions that will have to be paid out. Oh wait, they don't have a problem with those pensions and those payrolls when it's for cops and soldiers and stuff. It's just when it's for, like, teachers and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Not at their time, not in their pockets, on yours.
So yeah, this whole thing here, it's really crazy. And I would suggest that people go listen to that Lynn Albrecht interview with Tom Woods. She really drops a lot of stuff in there. And maybe I'll talk about that for just a minute when we come back. But we have something special to discuss.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
And there existed stickers. They used to not exist. Now they exist.
That's funny.
DJ, how do you like the Fiend stickers on our coffee pot?
They're gorgeous.
Yes. What do they say?
State speech is hate speech. And BIPCOT.org.
Yeah, and people can get them by going to freedomfiends.com and clicking on the new link at the top. It says stickers. And there will be more designs. So check back regularly. Catch them all.
Worms.
And I'm joined by Cal, and I'm going to throw to Cal in a minute, and we're going to talk about something that's some good news, some redemption of the third act. But I just wanted to touch a little bit more on the Silk Road trial. Those of you that have ever met Lynn Albrecht or heard her talk at an event or even seen a YouTube video with her recounting the story, it's really amazing. The things that happened in this trial and it really points to the complete corruption of the legal system. One of the things that she recounted was how they had presented evidence or made appeals on something, and the judge had ruled, okay, yeah, this makes sense, and okay, yeah, we're going to do this and do that. And then the next day, or it was after a long weekend, they came back, but the next day in court, everything that she had said was reversed. It was potentially exculpatory evidence that was presented. Everything had been reversed. The jury was instructed to ignore everything. It was almost as if somebody had contacted the judge. I'm not saying this happened, but it would be a plausible thing. Somebody contacted the judge and says, no, you're going to do this because this whole thing here, and this was a thought that Lynn had suggested, the Silk Road and Bitcoin and everything else, it presents a possible upheaval to the existing system. So I don't know what you think on that, Cal.
Yeah, I say like it's out of the bag now, right? You know, with Bitcoin hitting 11,000, it's going to be, everyone's going to be talking about it now. Not just, you know, what Alice Roderick helped perpetuate and accepting it as a form of currency there, but it's not going to be minor news anymore. I think inevitably, the more that people look at this and look at the history and the things that has been associated, I think it's going to get a lot more attention for him, which is a good thing. I don't know if that'll reopen the case. I don't know how many other ways that may help, but, you know, at least giving attention to him that he's not forgotten, I think it's like a big thing that can be done for people in his situation. Because, you know, a life sentence is something that a lot of people are kind of dismayed about and kind of feel,
I believe it was a double life sentence plus 45 years.
Oh, my God.
Plus 45 years.
Plus 45 years. So, you know, I think the situation of the Bitcoins now, and people will look into it and read more about it, it will lead to him. And, you know, I believe he receives mail. So if people want to write to him, I think that's a great thing. It's, you know, keep it alive. You know, people talk about fiat currency, inevitably it's going to be zero. So maybe he won't have to serve two life sentences plus 45, maybe in our lifetime when it collapses and all this is, the show's over, he might have freedom. He might see something, he might see a light, all thanks to Bitcoin driving real currency, real money into this world.
That would be nice. So, all right, the redemption of the third act. This is the anniversary. Tell us about how Fidel Castro finally became a good commie.
So over the weekend last year, Fidel Castro finally kicked the bucket. So after, unfortunately, at an old age, but even still, people have been mutilated, tortured, murdered by this man in Cuba down across the Florida Keys. People have risked their lives trying to escape from him. You know, you never hear stories of people saying like, you know, I risked my life to escape capitalism. You hear like they risked their life to escape communism, socialism. And this is a man that has cruelly done many horrors to many people. You know, he created prison camps just to send gay people to, just because they're gay. You know, that's Fidel Castro. The first camps were created by Che Guevara. And, you know, so finally, you know, you could say there's some justice, but until, I guess it's overthrown or abolished in Cuba, you know, it's, I guess the work there is not done yet.
How many U.S. presidents did Castro outlive?
I know, right? I know.
Oh, gosh. I saw a picture today. It's supposed to be Che pointing a gun at people, and you never see that picture on the T-shirt.
Right. No, you don't. No, not that version.
So
you see the other version where people. You see the other version where people wear like the Hitler T-shirt. So yeah, my Che shirt is in the wash.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for getting in here a little bit late, but better late than never. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to Nathan for being supportive during my anxiety attacks of flying solo. And for more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com.